Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, climate change is here. But one Stanford University scientist has mapped out the way to slow it down and even reverse some of the damage. And first, how does climate change affect conception? Plus, how immigration could lead to greater democratization in the world. It depends where the migrants go, says our next guest. Margaret Peters is a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, the author of Trading Barriers, Immigration and the Remaking of Globalization, and co-author of Restraining the Huddled Masses, Migration Policy and Autocratic Survival.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Margaret Peters. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to talk to you about this research you've done. You and your co-author have been looking at immigration, migration, really, and how it affects democratization. And it was kind of fascinating to think that where somebody goes has an effect on the home country. Can you walk us through those findings?
Sure. So what we find in the paper is that when migrants from authoritarian countries, so countries run by dictators, countries run by the military, countries run by political parties like the Communist Party, where they don't have free and fair elections, when they go to democracies, we find that then they spread the norms of democracy back home, and this leads to greater democratization at home. And so what we think is going on is that, and there's a fair amount of literature in sociology and political science that set this on a more case-by-case example, is that when migrants come to a country like the U.S. or go to countries in the EU from authoritarian countries, they learn just sort of about everyday politics and life in a democracy. So they might be learning like, hey, a cop stops me but doesn't ask me for a bribe. That's different. Or they might, you know, if they send their kids to school, they might say like, oh, it's okay in the U.S. to challenge the principal or challenge the teacher, whomever the authority figure is, on something that's going on. That's not what happens in my country. Or they might think, look at things like the free press and learn about their home country, or just learn about how politics happens in a democracy. So there's all these different opportunities for learning about political life that's very different from their life at home, which then they can either tell their friends and families about, or they might return home with that knowledge.
Maybe an example or two would actually show when you have immigrants moving to, say, a European country, where have you seen greater democratization happening?
One of the best examples of this is probably in Mexico, coming to the United States. So there's a fair amount of research showing that the migrants who came to the United States under the Farm Workers Program learned a lot about democracy in the U.S. And during that time period, Mexico was an autocracy. It was run by the PRI, or the, what's known as the PRI party. And they learned a lot about democracy and how what the PRI was doing was, even though it held elections, was not really democracy. And so they helped become a constituency for Democratic parties, and especially for this one party, the PRD, which is more of a leftist party or a more sort of center-left party. And when we saw greater support for the PRD, and especially in 94, when we had more of free election happen in Mexico, these areas with migrants were greater supporters for democratic change. So it helps sort of state this constituency for democracy.
Have you seen that go in other directions as well?
We can see some of that happening in places around the Arab Spring. So one of the interesting sort of correlations that are out there, and we're still working on nailing down that this has in fact happened directly, is that you had the Great Recession happen in 2008. And this meant that a lot of people who used to go from North Africa or the Middle East to Europe could no longer go to Europe because there were no longer jobs in Europe to go to. There were stronger border enforcement. There were fewer visas to get. And so people who had been going back and forth or who had been planning to go to Europe suddenly were stuck at home. And so a lot of these younger folks who maybe had been going to Europe for work and were now stuck at home and were part of the protest. And while that did not lead in all cases, it really only led to full democratization in the case of Tunisia, you saw a lot of support in the region from people who were former migrants to Europe, or who had family members in Europe and had learned you know, what was going on in Europe and how political life was different there.
Was there a role at all with the Global Compact?
Well, the Global Compact is sort of still in the beginning stages of discussion. I would like to see a larger role for these sorts of discussions of politics in things like the Global Compact or, you know, like the World Bank talks a lot about, you know, the importance of migration on development, but rarely ever talks about its role in political development and the role that migrants can play spreading these norms of democracy, which, you know, is frustrating because, you know, they're always focusing on economic development and they talk about how politics is very important for economic development and we have to get the right sort of institutions. So to sort of be ignoring this channel is frustrating as a scholar.
Well, this is the first time we've really even heard the words Global Compact around these issues. And my wonder is, this is an awareness that is growing to some degree that we're going to have these conversations. The question is related to both these discussions that happen on a global level, whether or not they come to full implementation, and an effect at all on issues of democratization.
I think it's great that people are hearing more about it. And I think where we could maybe get more buy-in and more support. So the U.S. is totally out of the Global Compact at this point.
Yeah.
So that they're not going to participate. But you look at places where you have more openness to the ideas of a Global Compact. So you think about like Canada, maybe Australia, maybe New Zealand, and those smaller, you know, Scandinavian countries, the smaller powers that, you know, I think that getting this idea that democratization, that migrants can help spread democracy and that, you know, this will be good for the world in general, because we think that having greater democracy and greater freedom is good for peace. You know, democracies don't go to war with each other, all of those sorts of good things. I think that could become part of the discussion about the Global Compact and maybe help think about maybe these states should have more regularized, you know, labor programs where, you know, workers can come from authoritarian countries and work and earn money and help their families back home, but also come and learn about democracy while abroad. And that don't just want, you know, right now so many labor migrants are going to places like the Persian Gulf, they're going to Russia, they're going to Singapore, countries that are extremely not democratic. And while they're earning a lot of money and this is helping their family back home and that's good for the migrants and their families, it's not necessarily good for their country. Because another finding that we have in the paper is that when migrants go to other autocracies, so when they go to the Persian Gulf, go to Singapore, you know, they're sending back money home and they're leaving the country and taking out some of the energy maybe for political opposition. And the money they're sending back is sort of being misattributed to the leaders. In all places, at all times, as Bill Clinton said, it's the economy, stupid. So when people's economy, personal economy is doing well, they tend to support the leader regardless of who the leader is. And so by having people just go to places like them, having the only opportunity to go to places like the Persian Gulf means that your migration is actually bolstering authoritarianism. Whereas if they can come to Western consolidated democracies, that could actually lead to greater democratization.
And you've also said that it leads to democratization in a sort of cheap way.
Right. So not only a cheap way, but, you know, you can think about it. We actually, if you think about like the GDP being, you know, making money, we actually in the developed world make money or increase our GDP when we bring in more immigrants. So just by having more workers around, we can produce more stuff. There's not much evidence that especially low-skill workers from developing countries are really labor market threats to natives. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that they complement natives in the developed world. And so you can sort of like do democracy promotion on the cheap, or even as I jokingly say, make money off of it without concerns of real economic harm to your native population.
And also you have found the relationship between trade and immigration. How do you see this?
Yeah, so that's in my first book, the stuff on migration and democratization will hopefully be my second book, Trading Barriers. immigration, the remaking of globalization. And there I find that there's this really robust negative relationship between open borders, between trade and migration. And so what has happened as we've opened our country and most of the developed world to more and more trade in goods. So think about all those like products we get it from China or from elsewhere in the developing world. That leads to the closure of low skill intensive businesses or businesses that use a lot of low skill labor here in the United States and in Europe. And when those businesses close, they no longer support open immigration. They were once the major employers of immigration, of immigrant workers. And once they close, they no longer support immigration and provide that political support. So to give you an example, textiles here in the United States, where I'm located, used to be a major employer of immigrant labor. And the textile industry has shrunk in size and has become much more capital intensive in the U.S. and just doesn't even lobby for immigration any longer, where they used to be a major industry player in lobbying for immigration. So you see this sort of differences between trade having this effect. As we open trade more, there's less industry support for immigration, which makes it all the much harder then to like have these good benefits, migration on democratization.
Well, Margaret Peters, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about my work.
Margaret Peters is a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, the author of Trading Barriers, Immigration and the Remaking of Globalization, and co-author of Restraining the Huddled Masses, Migration Policy and Autocratic Survival. When we come back, how is climate change affecting conception and birth rates? Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We know there are higher death rates happening because of climate change, but how is it affecting birth rates? Our next guest has some answers. Alan Bereka is a professor at the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. He is the author of the research paper, Does Hot Weather Affect Human Fertility? Co-author of Maybe Next Month, Temperature Shocks, Climate Change and Dynamic Adjustment in Birth Rates, and Adapting to Climate Change, the Remarkable Decline in the U.S. Temperature-Mortality Relationship over the 20th Century.
So welcome to the Scholar Circle, Alan Bereka. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been studying the human impacts, some of the human impacts that arise from climate change, both kind of from the mortality aspect, but also from the fertility aspect.
Yeah, that's correct.
Maybe we should start with mortality. Would you say your work suggests there's been an adaptation to climate change?
Yes, there's been a pretty big adaptation since the 1940s and 50s, especially. And this messes up with a period when air conditioning was rolling out across the United States. And I arrived at this conclusion about the importance of adaptation from looking at mortality records from the United States going back all the way to 1900. So looking at periods, say, in California that were unusually hot, do they time up with periods where you see also spikes in death rates? And what we found was, yes, so hot weather causes more deaths. And I think that the striking thing is that the early 20th century United States was very similar to, say, India or other developing countries today in terms of our vulnerability to hot weather. It was a major killer. And it's really staggering how much more adapted or how much less vulnerable we became after the 1950s, 60s, 70s, when air conditioning really, really rolled out across the United States.
Yeah, so that's interesting because simultaneously rolling out that air conditioning then just contributes to climate change, which just means we get hot again.
I know, it really is the unfortunate bit of my public health advice, which is I think that air conditioning is a very effective public health tool. The challenge with this is that it increases greenhouse gas emissions, which then leads to more climate change, which then adds to a public health problem.
Right.
So potentially with cleaner energy, I think we can have both the health savings from air conditioning without as much of the health costs. So that would be my hope and dream, is that as we adapt with more air conditioning, and I think that seems to be a really great strategy, that we also cut back on our fossil fuels.
Now, what exactly are the things that are causing the mortality? Can you tell that from your research? I did notice one thing you pointed to was humidity specifically. Do we have a sense of why is it that with more heat, higher mortality rates?
So cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death around the world, and our cardiovascular health is also very sensitive to the temperature. Our bodies are just working much harder during the heat and also during the cold to regulate our temperature. So pumping blood closer to the surface of our skin, sweating, and that puts a strain on the body. So if you're already, already at risk to cardiovascular disease and you add extreme temperatures on top of that, a heat wave, then that's what's leading to most of the deaths, actually.
Now, you also looked at fertility. And so you noticed fertility rates were in decline in certain regions. Can you walk us through what you found and what these relationships are to climate change?
Okay, so what I noticed in the data in the U.S. and say in New Zealand or Australia or, in Europe, is that we actually see fewer births in the spring months and more births in the summer months. So I wanted to know whether temperature or seasonal fluctuations in the weather could predict this. So similar to my research on death and mortality, I went back and I collected death records, fertility records in the U.S., birth rates going back to the 1930s. And this is like 200 plus million births over this time period, so going all the way back to the 1930s. And I matched it up with weather data. And I looked at, okay, if it's an unusually hot August, say in California in 1947, what happens to birth rates 9 months later? Obviously, since, around the time of, conception, between conception and birth, there's going to be some delay of about 9 months for most births. So I'm looking from August 47, say to May of 1948. What do we see? We actually see a big reduction in births. So each hot day results in about 1,000 fewer births that 9 months later. And so this can help explain why we see a dip in births during the spring months.
And so what do we attribute this to? How is the climate affecting conception?
Well, there's two, obvious ways in which this temperature extreme heat could impact our conception chances. The first being sexual activity. So if it's extremely hot, maybe that just makes all physical activity more uncomfortable, so people are conceiving less. But I should say that I looked at the data and it doesn't seem to back that story up. The second potential explanation is that hot weather, just like for our chances of dying, hot weather is a strain on human health, and health is important for our conceptions. So if you're not in good health, your chances of successfully conceiving go down. And the data seem to back this up.
So I wonder, I know you study human mortality and human birth rates, but I wonder if, since you said air conditioning has this really important effect on making sure that we stay alive, because it supports our cardiovascular, et cetera, could this be connected to the reduction in certain animals and the climate-related deaths in animals because they can't conceive as much and because of the stress on their bodies?
I'd say it's very, very plausible. So for humans, one of the leading reasons why, temperature might be causing a reduction in our conception chances is that actually human mammals we're very sensitive to the heat, especially males. So the testes, They require temperatures that are just a few degrees below the natural core body temperature. And other animals actually have the same necessities. So what, as part of this research, I dug in a little bit into the animal studies, and I found some cases where for bulls, say, for example, that their sperm actually production actually was reduced following exposure to extreme heat. So it's very likely.
So if you were going to map this out a little bit, and I think that you did a little bit of that in your study, where are you seeing the effects the most?
This is actually, it's a bit complicated because on one hand, places that experience a lot of hot weather, say like the southern part of the United States, so Louisiana, so places like that that experience a lot of hot weather are more vulnerable. But on the other hand, places like Louisiana that experience a lot of hot weather are just more adapted. They're just used to it. So I used to live in New Orleans, and I can say that it's pretty rare to not have air conditioning in your home or your place of work. So there are these two countervailing forces. But it seems like with climate change, so say going to the next 50 years, the places that are going to be the most vulnerable will potentially be places like San Francisco, Seattle, where there's really very little air conditioning. And as the temperatures rise, before this adaptation kicks in, people are going to suffer.
And then you wrote about a rebound effect. What is this?
So going back to the main finding, we saw that during the hot summer month, there was a reduction in births 9 months later. Okay, so if it's a really hot summer and you're unable to conceive and you continue engaging in unprotected sex, whether or not you're intentionally trying to get pregnant or unintentionally do so, that if you can't conceive in the summer months, that you may just push out those conceptions to November or December. Okay, so that's in some ways good news in terms of our ability to adapt. If you don't conceive in the summer months, you go on to try in the winter months and you're successful. But there's a bit of bad news with that. Even if you're able to make up the conceptions that were lost in the summer in the winter, all those births, a winter conception, those conceptions are going to be born in the following summer. That means third trimester, those women and fetuses are exposed to extreme heat, even more so with climate change. And there's good research, some of which I'm working on right now, to show that extreme heat in the third trimester is bad for fetal health.
So then there's the other aspect of this, which is overall, one of the largest contributors to climate change has been said to be having children. And so when you look at this sort of big picture, like, you know, having fewer children as a result of climate change might actually be a mitigation effect in some way, you know, overpopulation arguments and this sort of a thing.
So I don't really, I don't get a lot of satisfaction from that interpretation, even though I'm very sympathetic to it. For one, those costs are going to be borne on people that are poor and don't have access to air conditioning. And those are not the people that are actually doing the greenhouse gas emitting. So that's kind of upsetting. Two, if we really are concerned about population growth, relying on climate to do the job for us is not an effective strategy. There are some very effective strategies for reducing population growth, and they are providing women with birth control and giving women better employment and educational opportunities. So it's a really ineffective way of solving this climate.
Yeah. Well, I certainly wasn't suggesting it was the way to solve. what I was suggesting is that it is potentially sort of another effect toward. And, you know, it's interesting, too, the countries that do have, like you said, air conditioning or better access to doctors, for example, mm-hmm. you know, their birth rates are already a bit lower anyway.
Yeah, that's true. And this brings up an important point about where the population growth is a concern and where it isn't. So in countries like the United States, we actually have population growth rates that a lot of policy makers are considering to be too low. And the fact is that our population is aging, and so we have fewer workers who are paying into the tax system to support the elderly that are now collecting, say, Social Security. So that from a developed country policy, that's also really problematic.
And so where do we go from here with the knowledge that we have on mortality, conception, and climate change?
I think the big takeaway from this is that there are effective strategies for adapting to climate change, and this is air conditioning being the leading case. But it's going to come with more greenhouse gas emissions, and so we need to be simultaneously reducing our dependence on fossil fuels and energy sources that are contributing to climate change.
Alan Bareka, I thank you so much for coming on to the Scholar Circle and sharing your research with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alan Bareka is a professor at the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. He is the author of the research paper, Does Hot Weather Affect Human Fertility? Co-author of Maybe Next Month, Temperature Shocks, Climate Change, and Dynamic Adjustment in Birth Rates, and Adapting to Climate Change, the Remarkable Decline in the U.S. Temperature-Mortality Relationship over the 20th Century. When we come back, reversing climate change? Can it be done? Our next guest says it can. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest has been working to take the world to 100% renewable energy by 2050, which he argues can slow down climate change and reverse some of the damage. Mark Jacobson is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. He's also co-founder of the Solutions Project, 100.org, and the 100% Clean Renewable Energy Movement. His papers include A Path to Sustainable Energy by 2030, 100% Clean and Renewable Wind, Water, Sunlight, All Sector Energy Roadmaps for the 50 United States, and he's done the same for 139 countries and for 53 towns and cities in North America.
Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Mark Jacobson. It is great to have you back with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So you and I first met on this program after your Scientific American piece, where you paved this possible way to get to all renewable energy by 2030, I think it was. I thought we should start there and fast forward, because it's been about 10 years now, about the obstacles that you have seen. So what you saw at that point versus what are the obstacles we're seeing now?
Well, there's been a lot of good progress, so maybe I'll start with that. So first of all, just to describe our plans, they were, in 2009, we did a plan, well, it was more like a vision for the entire world. Can we, in our calculation, can we actually transition the entire world for all purposes to 100% wind, water, and solar for electricity, transportation, heating, cooling, and industry? So we would basically go through each energy sector, electrify everything as much as possible. In some cases, like for transportation, so we'd use some hydrogen for long distance transportation. But even the hydrogen would be produced from electricity. And then all the electricity would be produced by just wind and water and solar power. So onshore and offshore wind, solar photovoltaics on rooftops and in power plants, concentrated solar power, some geothermal power, existing hydroelectric power, and small amounts of tidal and wave power. So that would be everything for all purposes worldwide. So we determined, well, it's technically possible to do this back in 2009. I mean, there's enough wind and solar by far to do this in particular. Even the costs were reasonable even at that time, but and they were coming down. But there were social and political barriers to overcome. Now, since then, well, we've also developed plans for all 50 United States, more specific plans than that general world plan in 2009, and for 139 countries, and now for 53 towns and cities across North America. And so recently, in the last couple of years in particular, there are over like 75 towns and cities and counties in North America alone have committed to go to 100% renewable energy for their all their operations, or for trying to convince their the citizens to do it as well. In addition, there are around 140 international companies, including the major companies of the world, that have committed to transitioning to 100% renewable energy. Two companies, Google and Apple, have claimed they're already at 100%, and several others are close. And we have several states that in the United States that have either passed a law. In the case of Hawaii, they have a 100% renewable electricity law by 2045, or proposed laws. In fact, next week, California is going to vote on SB 100, which, if passed, and it's expected to pass, will result in California committing to go to 100% for all electric power by 2045, with 60% by 2030. Other states have their passed or proposed laws. Vermont has a 70% law, and Massachusetts has a law to go to 100% that's being proposed. And Washington State also has one that'll be 100% law that still hasn't been voted on. So there's a lot of progress has been made. And there's also several countries such as Sweden, Costa Rica, Iceland, that are virtually at 100% renewable electricity already. And the world has a long way to go. I mean, worldwide, we're only like 4 or 5% there. We need to go another 95% on average. But the costs of energy have come down significantly. Wind and solar costs are the cheapest forms of new electric power worldwide. Now, but battery storage has come down in cost. Electric vehicles are now widespread and growing. And different countries are proposing to transition transportation and homes as well as industry. So there's a lot of good news, but there are still barriers because there's still a strong fossil fuel industry that wants to stay in power. And they, they'll spend a lot of money to try to lobby and influence public opinion against renewable energy. There's still barriers, and a lot of politicians still take money from these fossil fuel industries, and they still, as a result, some politicians will pass laws that will make it more difficult to transition.
Well, let's take these a little bit apart. Let's start with, you mentioned Sweden and Costa Rica. What did they transition to? What are they using for their 100% renewable?
Well, in a lot of cases, the countries that are really far along have a lot of hydroelectric power already installed, but they are also installing wind, in some cases solar. In the case of Sweden, it's more wind. And then there's also geothermal, like in Iceland, there's a lot of geothermal, and as well as wind, not much solar in Iceland. But yeah, it's a combination of those four, wind, solar, hydroelectric, and geothermal. But the ones that are furthest along, almost all of them have just huge amounts of hydroelectric available. And it's, they've had it for a while, so it's not like they've had to grow that. But they've then supplemented it with wind and or solar or geothermal to try to get them close to 100%.
So the thing that's enabling those countries to go to 100% now is primarily that they already had in place, so like New Zealand, predominantly hydro as well, hydropower. And so the transition would not be nearly as difficult to 100% as it would be a country that has largely relied on fossil fuels.
Correct. I mean, well, I should keep in mind that electricity where, I mean, so these countries have a lot of hydro and it's been supplying a lot of their electric power. But electric power is only about 20% of all end use energy in most countries. So to transition everything in a country, you need to transition transportation, home heating, and in some cases cooling, that's not already electric, and industry to electricity, and then provide the electricity with clean, renewable energy. So when I say like Costa Rica is like a 99% and Iceland's at a virtually at 100% renewable energy, that's in the electric power sector, but they still have fossil fuel vehicles and industry, and those have to be transitioned. So that's going to require more wind and solar, because except like some places like Iceland, they have more capability of hydro, but a lot of places are not going to grow hydroelectric power very much, although some places still can. So it's really going to be wind and solar in most places, in some cases geothermal. But you know, we've done the numbers for 139 countries, which represent basically 99% of the energy of the world. And we find it's possible. There's enough wind and solar to satisfy all these countries many times over.
So if we were going to put this into the context of sort of the current realities that we're facing with climate, and, you know, just from, you know, a common person's look across the world to see that the storms have been getting more intense and the fires have been getting more intense, these are the things that we were warned about by scientists. It seems like we're seeing some of the predictions come to fruition. Maybe we should start there. Is that in fact what's happening? Is that what is behind all of this?
Yeah, well, we have globally average higher temperatures about over 1 degree Celsius or Kelvin higher than in the late 1800s. So, you know, it might not sound like a lot, but, you know, an average global temperature increase of 1 degree Celsius or Kelvin really means there are extreme increases in some places like the Arctic, up to 5 degrees Celsius, and much, you know, but in other places, like there's very little increase. But the other thing is an average increase over the year really means you get extremes, more extremes of both hot and cold. But they just average out to like a 1 degree average worldwide and yearly. But you do get these short periods of really high temperatures and also really low temperatures in some cases. So there's this more extreme weather. And that extreme weather causes more damage in terms of heat waves, fires that start when you have drier weather, in terms of more severe storms, more severe hurricanes, more intense hurricanes, for example. And you also get more air pollution with higher temperatures, too. I mean, higher temperatures increase ozone pollution in air that's already polluted. And this causes more mortalities as well. Higher temperatures also increase certain diseases, such as malaria, dengue fever, and this causes more damage. Also causes damage to crops. The higher carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere result in higher carbon dioxide levels in the ocean. And carbon dioxide is an acid, so it causes the oceans to become more acidic. So you get acidic oceans. Well, they're not quite acidic, but they're more acid than they were, and this is causing killing off coral reefs. So the Great Barrier Reef is in peril, already damaged significantly. So there's damage to the oceans and the atmosphere in terms of pollution, in terms of weather, in terms of climate, in terms of agriculture and the ground, and also water supplies are endangered. And you got heat stress and heat stroke. I mean, a lot of people who are, let's say, living in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, so temperatures are already hot there, and suddenly you have even higher temperatures, and then agricultural crops fail, so you get famine. So there's risk of mass starvation, and some of this has already occurred in some places. And climate change has also resulted in war and climate refugees, people having to leave their land because they can't, it's no longer tillable. So there's all sorts of disasters occurring worldwide as a result of climate change already.
And so the question then becomes, if we were to take this blueprint that you and your colleague have mapped out and say we do manage to get to all renewables by, say, 2030 or 2050 even, how much of an impact can that make given the sort of acceleration it seems like that we're already in?
Well, so our plans are really to transition 80% of everything to clean renewable energy by 2030 and 100% by 2050. We think that this can result in the slowing of global warming and its eventual reversal by 2100. And it'll result, more importantly, in the immediate benefits to human health of, because there are 4 to 7 million people die each year from air pollution from the same fossil fuels that cause climate change. And so by eliminating these emissions so quickly, 80% by 2030 and 100% by 2050, you're eliminating immediately 4 to 7 million deaths per year. And, but the benefit to climate takes longer, might not be realized until 2100, even if we eliminate all emissions today, because carbon emitted, yesterday is going to stay in the atmosphere for on the order of 70 years. And so it takes time to cleanse the atmosphere of the greenhouse gases and polluting particles that cause warming. More the gases that cause warming, it'll take time. Whereas the pollutant particles that cause health impacts, they can be eliminated. Their elimination today will, in terms of their emissions, will scrub them from the atmosphere quickly, because particles have a very short lifetime in the atmosphere of on the order of weeks, whereas gases, particularly greenhouse gases, have lifetimes of decades to, in some cases, centuries. So we think we can solve the problem, but it does require this rapid transition, 80% by 2030. And unless we do that, then this warming will continue and get worse until we do decide to solve it. And even then, it'll take a while after that for the problem to be solved.
One of the things that happened after you put that report out was that there were a few people that criticized your modeling, and particularly about the cost and your assertion that in the long run it's cheaper to go renewable. Can you tell us a little bit about who your critics were and why they thought your models were off, and then what your response was to that?
Well, yeah, we've faced a lot of critics, and they generally just don't like the idea of transitioning, and so they find some reason to criticize. But there were critics back in 2009, and they were saying, well, the costs are way too high, and if that were the case, the costs have come down so substantially for wind and solar and batteries and pretty much all the renewable energy systems that right now wind and solar are the cheapest forms of new electric power, even cheaper than gas. And as a result, this is why there's so much installation now, even without mandates in a lot of places. So I think most people now are agreeable that renewables are the cheapest form of electric power, and so the costs are reasonable. Now, I think there is pushback in the sense that, okay, if we want to transition the current energy infrastructure, we have to retire a lot of fossil fuel plants early, and that will result in a hidden cost to, you know, whoever purchased those fossil fuel systems in the first place. But I would argue that the health and climate cost benefits of shutting those plants down early is far greater than the costs of those plants, that the kind of the embedded cost of the plants that is lost by shutting them down. And so it is still beneficial to, from a societal point of view, to shut those down, because you do get this health and climate cost is so significant that, you know, reducing that is paramount importance. The other concern that people have had is, well, can you keep the grid stable with just clean renewable energy, wind and solar? In fact, we do think we can. We've done studies on this looking at, we looked at 20 world regions, and with each region just producing all its energy for all purposes with wind and solar, geothermal, hydroelectric, tidal wave power, but everything being electrified. So we have the heat sector being electrified for home heating and business heating, also industry being electrified and transportation being electrified. And we find that by using storage not only electricity storage, but also heat storage and cold storage and some hydrogen storage, together with the fact that wind and solar are what are called intermittent. The wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine. But by combining that factor with storage and with what's called demand response, where utilities give people incentives not to use electricity at certain times of the day, that we can actually keep the grid stable at low cost everywhere. And actually, the problem becomes easier when we electrify all sectors because there's more modes of storage that we can invoke at that point, including heat storage, cold storage, and hydrogen storage. And so we think that it's not a problem. And in fact, you know, places where they've increased the amount of renewables on the grid, they've, especially like in Germany, for example, but also in places like Iceland, Costa Rica, and Norway and Sweden, their grid is staying stable because there are many options of storage, including hydroelectric as a version of storage. Batteries have come down in cost in South Australia. Now they're putting these huge battery systems together with their wind and solar to keep the grid stable. And then there's concentrated solar powers, which is associated with storage. There's also pumped hydroelectric power. So these are all existing storage technologies for electricity. But there's also, as I mentioned, for heat and cold.
So you've also said that the biggest barrier is really people's perception that it's too hard. Simultaneously, in the United States, of course, there's Donald Trump at the presidency who seems to actively be trying to cripple the renewable industry and the efforts of states like California to move closer to renewables. How are you dealing with this, given, you know, your efforts? I know you've created this nonprofit solutions organization to try to move this along, but you've got to sort of deal with the politics as well.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, in the case of the United States, the Trump administration, they've been more pro fossil fuels and less pro renewable. And that has actually galvanized a lot of people at the state and local levels to act, and has actually pushed forward the 100% renewable energy plans at the state and local levels even further than probably if Trump wasn't pushing for coal and oil and gas. So, I mean, that's a silver lining, I guess, at this end of this bleak tunnel, is that there is this strong movement. In fact, this will culminate in California, where SB 100 is a bill that has passed the state Senate and is now going to be voted on by the assembly, and is likely going to pass next week, and will mandate that California will go to 100% renewable by 2045, and it'll almost for sure be signed by the governor too. So but also at city levels, lots of cities have now committed to going to 100% renewable energy. And in fact, there was a worldwide poll in 13 countries anyway, that of 26,000 people, where about 82% of the people want 100% renewable energy. And so this is a lot of people. So with that many people who really want this to move forward, you know, there are going to be people who are against it, and who have a lot of financial backing. But there are so many more people who are for it. And ultimately, because of the low cost, and it will move forward. I mean, in the United States, even the top 10, 9 out of the top 10 states with the highest fraction of electricity from wind are all Republican states. So these are states that voted for Trump. So they just see the economical benefit of wind power, for example, because it's so cheap, and that doesn't stop them from putting it up. And so, and even, Trump's support of coal, the fact is coal is still dying and coal plants are being shut down still. So he's not going to, he can say all he wants, but the fact is it's such an inefficient industry and costly industry that it's dying on its own.
So in terms of the industries themselves and him and Trump's attempt to prop up those industries and attack the renewable industries. So I know that Barack Obama had put some things into place to support some of the renewable industries growth to expand renewable energy across the United States, for example. How are the renewable energy companies doing in the face of this?
Well, I think like any industry, there are many companies that are doing well, and there are others that are not doing well, and some are closing down. So I don't know, like on a day-to-day basis, how they're doing, or even a month-to-month basis. But I do know that, you know, solar is really growing strong still worldwide and in the United States, and there's a lot of development going on, and wind is as well. And so are batteries and storage. So these are all good signs, but I think you'll always find examples of some companies that are not doing well and others that are doing well.
Right, of course. And then there's the Solutions Project that you're involved in. What would you like people to know about that?
So the Solutions Project is a nonprofit that I helped co-found starting in 2011, although it became formal only in 2013. I co-founded it with Mark Ruffalo, who's an actor and activist, and Josh Fox, who's a movie director, a documentary director, and Marco Craples, who's in business. And really the idea was to take the energy plans that we've been developing for states and cities and now countries also, and to try to educate the public and policymakers about them, to really engage the public and to try to then work with people in the public to actually help implement the plans in places such as inner cities, in rural areas, but really everywhere. So it's really, the idea is 100% clean renewable energy for 100% of the people. So make sure nobody is left behind in this energy transition, and to try to benefit everybody through a transition. And so the Solutions Project has also done a lot in galvanizing other nonprofits. And in fact, there's a network of over 70 nonprofits that are on board with 100% clean renewable energy. And a lot of this has been galvanized through the Solutions Project. But there are other organizations such as Sierra Club and Greenpeace and 350.org and many others that have been strongly involved as well.
And then I know that when you look internationally, there are some countries that are still, you know, working towards some transition, but maybe at a pace that is not really going to get us there super fast either. And people frequently talk about China and India. What do you know that's happening there in the transition?
Well, yeah, in many developing countries, there is a lot of movement towards renewable energy, which is good. I mean, some of them, like China, has a huge growth. I mean, they're putting up more wind and solar than the U.S., but they're also putting up a lot of coal too. So this is a problem. I think that they're going to accelerate in the renewable and putting up more renewables. And I know India has a huge commitment for solar in particular, which I see as a positive step. I know many countries are, even in like the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia and Egypt. I mean, Egypt is putting up the largest solar farm in the world right now. And Saudi Arabia has commitments to put up lots of solar. And I know, but there are many countries that are moving forward because they just realize this is so necessary and inexpensive. And it's a way for them to provide energy security as well. It's jobs, it's energy security, it's low cost. So there's an incentive set up for many countries to transition. But again, every country has its own barriers, policy barriers and lobbyists and whatnot. So it does, but it does require this international effort to transition. And it requires, but not only policies, but individuals. I mean, individuals can do a lot on their own in each country. But so you need a combination of what individuals do and strong policies to be put in place. And that's really the goal. Our energy plans that we've developed for each country is really, the idea is to say, okay, well, give people confidence in the country that this is possible. And then hopefully policymakers will then take that to try to implement some of the goals. But of course, they'll have to decide themselves what the best way to implement the goals are. I mean, we're providing basically an end goal for each country, but it's up to the country to decide how to get there most efficiently. And in the end, the energy system will look probably different than what we propose, but it's really our idea is to say, okay, here's one possible way to get to 100% renewable energy. There are probably lots of ways, hundreds of ways to do it. So this just gives people confidence to try one way.
And so generally speaking, would you say that you remain optimistic about being able to reverse some of the climate effects, given that it looks like, if you watch the news regularly, that we're cooking the planet?
Yeah, I am optimistic there is a solution. Whether we implement it on time is a different question. But I am optimistic we will eventually transition to 100% clean renewable energy in most of the world, if not the whole world. I think there's a bandwagon effect where, you know, it's slow at first and then some changes occur in some places and then other places see they're losing out by not changing themselves. So they jump on board. So I think this is why California's passing SB 100 will be very important. I think this will spur on other states and countries to actually pass their own laws to go there as well, because California is now the fifth largest economy in the world in terms of GDP. And if California can do it, then that will really spur on other locations to do it as well.
Well, Mark Jacobson, I thank you for joining us one more time on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Mark Jacobson is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. He's also co-founder of the Solutions Project, 100.org, and the 100% Clean Renewable Energy Movement. His papers include A Path to Sustainable Energy by 2030, 100% Clean and Renewable Wind, Water, Sunlight, All Sector Energy Roadmaps for the 50 United States, and he's done the same for 139 countries and for 53 towns and cities in North America.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.